has been a pretty good day for me so far. It's 1:06 p.m. and nobody's offered me anything that was pumpkin spice yet. Where does that crap come from? Are there, like, factories that work all year round to get ready for the pumpkin spice season? It's like a flu vaccine. What if we don't have enough of it? Are there really people who look forward to it? Only 6 more weeks and CVS is going to start having pumpkin spice mouthwash. Today on a special pumpkin spice edition of The Nose, we're back in New Haven to talk about internet music sensation Alison Gold, the successor to Rebecca Black, and the reason I'm using pumpkin spice Q-tips to get the sound of that Chinese food song out of my ears. You'll also learn the Spanish word for a father who produces only daughters. And now, the confused old man who mixed up the national anthem last night. No, wait, that was James Taylor. Colin McEnroe.
All right, yes, we are in New Haven today. We're very excited to be here on in our Audubon Street studios. We're also very excited to welcome some panelists to The Nose, who include two brand new virgin panelists to The Nose. But first of all, a grizzled veteran of many Nose appearances, Mark Oppenheimer, is here with us. He is an author and the manager of the best managed journalism career in Connecticut and possibly the United States. There's virtually not a significant publication that Mark Oppenheimer has not written for. And now it's sort of started to be that he writes for publications that I didn't even know exist, but are cool.
They pay you in coolness.
Well, I bookmarked the new one, which we'll be talking about here on the show today, his latest journalism triumph. And I bookmarked that publication, Medium, medium.com?
It's owned by Twitter. It's the new platform.
Is it? Yeah. That is so cutting edge, though.
So the Twitter people decided they were getting all these comments saying, what if you have something longer than that you want to say? So they created a blogging platform out of the Twitter technology.
All right. Sitting to Mark's left is Helen Cowder. She is the executive director of ArtSpace, a terrific gallery in New Haven's Ninth Square. We've actually done a broadcast from there. Also making her debut appearance from Yale Medical School, Dr. Jen Stockwell. No, she's not actually a doctor. But the right way to say it is, you do web design for them? Or
no, graphic design.
Graphic design. My error. All right. So first of all, we also welcome you. You can be part of this conversation. You'd have to know what the conversation was going to be about before you could really divine your eagerness to do that. But I'll tell you anyway, because we're wrapping the 203 here, that the number to call is 203-776-WNPR. That's 203. It's not the usual number. 203-776-WNPR. We're going to start out by, in fact, hurting your eardrums a little bit and talking about the latest viral music phenomenon. In order to do that, and I think Kyone's on the board right now. Kyone has been glaring at me all day today because she had to pull this audio, which meant that she had to listen to it again. But to help you understand this, we have to sort of throw you back a year or so ago to the emergence of a phenomenon known as Rebecca Black. Once again, to reacquaint you with the delights of Rebecca Black, here's her 59 million YouTube viewer phenomenon Friday.
It's Friday, Friday, gotta get down on Friday. Everybody looking forward to the weekend, weekend. Friday, Friday, getting down on Friday. Everybody
enough! Enough! Make it stop! Anyway, this video became unbelievably viral, 59 million views. And for Rebecca Black, I mean, she was initially this unheard of person she was a very young person whose parents seemed to have, as maybe some little present for her or something. I'm not sure I really know the backstory, but they arranged to have this song produced for her, and then she stars in the video, and she's gone on to other things as a result. And Katy Perry actually features her in another Friday Night related video. So it's all a very happy ending, except that it didn't end, because the same people who did that, they have to keep going. They have to do other things. They are sort of a music factory. Leader is a guy named Patrice Wilson. So he has found 12-year-old Alison Gold. And in order to pleasure us in a brand new way, Alison Gold appears in a video which currently has more than 11 million views. It's only been out a few days. It currently has more than 11 million views. It's called Chinese Food. We'll hear a little bit of Chinese Food.
Chinese food.
Yes.
Fade out on broccoli. Yeah,
I was hoping you'd play that part.
All right. Well, actually, I can quote from his deathless poetry. They got broccoli, even chicken wings. I like the egg rolls and the wonton soup. That's actually the lyric. This is sort of the triumph of the amateur over the professional. Alison Gold was nobody in particular, except probably somebody whose parents were able to help pay for some of this. It's a phenomenon already. Jen Stockwell, I know that you've been sort of binging, perhaps unhappily, on the products of Patrice Wilson and his ARC music machine. So any theories about, why does this stuff... we're going to talk a little bit later about the kind of casual racism that's in this video, but 11 million views in no time whatsoever, 59 million views for Rebecca Black. And these things, I think it's the only good thing you can say about the song Chinese Food is that if you have the song Friday stuck in your head and you listen to Chinese Food, there's a good possibility it will drive out the first thing, but then you'll have it stuck in its head. Any theories about what's going on here?
It makes no sense whatsoever. He's got another one about Thanksgiving, and it's just the inanity of it is outrageous. But he's in all the videos, and he seems legitimately into this, mm-hmm. which fascinates me. Like, he seems he says over and over again that there was no racist background to it, that he had no ill intentions, and he seems so down to earth and that's exactly how he feels. He really likes Chinese food, and he's going to write a song about it.
When we say he, this man is Patrice Wilson. He, at least casual observation, is a person of color. We meet him in this video when he's a person of black and white because he's in a giant panda suit. And we actually disturbingly see him and this young girl, Alison Gold, having this kind of little tickle fight in a field. And then later he takes the panda head off, and it's him. And there's sort of a creepiness factor that kind of sets it at that point. But I don't know. These things – you have daughters. We're going to be talking about how many daughters you have.
Let me back up. Yeah. And first of all, I wanted to say before I forget, to Kion's intro, I love pumpkin spice.
I
really look forward to – every year at some point I say the pumpkin spice products are back. You can get the pumpkin donut at Dunkin' Donuts. You can get the pumpkin spice latte at Starbucks.
Nothing less from a Cianciatore.
There's no reason you shouldn't be able to get pumpkin flavor year-round. The question isn't why do you get it this time of year. It's why not – why can you get a raspberry shot any time of year but not pumpkin? I want to put that out there. I have a theory about – about Friday, about Chinese food. It's not a profound theory, but I think it would have to not. If it were profound, something would be amiss. These are novelty songs, mm-hmm. and we need novelty songs. And we used to have novelty songs on the radio back when people listened to the radio. Now the entire radio listenership is right here. We actually have the entire they're listening. But for 12-year-olds as well as anyone else who has time to kill at work, these are novelty songs. And I was reading something some time ago that made the point that we don't see enough movies in common anymore that there are any catchphrases from movies. You never mm-hmm. have any – like that. Remember when they're used to
–
read my lips, or dude, where's my car or whatever. We don't have those anymore. Mm. But it's
dude,
good
dude, where's my car is a – I think that's a bridge point when the catchphrase became the title.
Became the title,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. That was a sign that what you're talking about was about to happen.
Right, because they had to make it the title to even make it a catchphrase. Right. But these are novelty songs and it's kind of cool. In my office, the hyper-educated man who – has the office next to me knocked on my door and said, "Have you seen the one about the fox?" I don't know if we're going to talk about if people have seen what does the fox say. Have you seen this one, Colin?
I haven't seen that. I've seen it alluded to. No.
So, oh well, it's
oh no, I have seen it.
It's like 100 million views,
yes,
and it's by this Danish or Norwegian group, and it's like we know what the cat says. The cat says meow, and the dog says woof. What does the fox say?
Right,
and it's set to a kind of synth beat, a sort of house music kind of thing.
And that guy has a whole series of those videos.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay, so thank goodness for novelty songs. They're fun. They're catchy. I don't share your disdain.
All right.
I one of the things that's funny about or curious about this video, it has this same catchy beat. It's interchangeable with the other song. But I don't know if any of you noticed, but every subtitle, every shot has a subtitle, the subtitle of what she's singing in a different language.
Different language, mm-hmm. yeah.
And I think part of this is maybe an astute move to try to appeal to audiences all over the globe. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why it's taken off is that it's so – and it starts out with a Chinese actor, sounding pretty good. So I think there's an appeal worldwide.
Patrice Wilson ain't dumb.
Yeah.
But one of the first comments was someone who said, "I speak Mandarin and these The subtitles. Sorry, I couldn't think of the word. Make absolutely no sense whatsoever. So I don't know about the other languages and whether it's translated correctly, but apparently in Chinese or Mandarin, it made no sense.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, the grumpy Chinese man at the beginning, or the somewhat angry sounding Chinese man at the beginning, and then the Chinese theme that runs through this, happy Chinese people waiting on you, this panda bear. But and then it gets a little dicey as we get into the area of, first of all, we have the Monopoly dog landing on Oriental Avenue, and then, of course, a scene at the end that evokes the classic and deathless Chinese tradition of geisha. And so, I mean, it feels like this is treading on... I mean, you couldn't make Breakfast at Tiffany's now and have Mickey Rooney be that character anymore, you know? And I feel like we're almost, in a very sort of innocent way, venturing into that. I mean, was anybody kind of bothered by the way the tropes were
I mean,
used?
The question is, I think, with regard to ethnic humor, you know, at what point are you dealing with an ethnic group that has sufficient social capital and it's arrived enough that they are fair game, right? So, I mean, I think, you know... Anglo-Saxon Protestants have long been fair game. You're not going to get in trouble if you mock them for whatever one might mock them for. Their gin and tonics, their sailboats. I don't know. I think it would be – you'd have a lot more latitude making fun of the Irish now than you would have 100 years ago. I mean, there's just not a lot of anti-Irish bigotry out there in America.
Or you do it a different way. And I think these days if you make fun of Asians, you can make fun of – I think on Colbert or someplace recently he used the phrase A minus. He said, or what Asian parents would consider a failing grade.
Right. The Asian F, right. So you know, but here, I mean, I think what gets a little uncomfortable about it is they're making fun of low status, you know, it's low status immigrants.
Right.
It's not making fun of, you know, Silicon Valley. Not that it's okay to make fun of Silicon Valley tech worker Asians, but especially when you're taking on low status, you know, people who work in what are essentially fast food jobs.
Right.
That's a little bit dicier.
Making fun of them, or maybe just sort of taking them for granted.
Taking them for granted.
Using them as props.
Yeah, and I think the geisha move, it's probably that, not even having thought about it. You know, like, well, all Asians, you know, they all look alike. So
his response to that was, oh, well, I wasn't implying that there's geishas in China. I'm implying that there are Chinese restaurants in Japan.
In Japan. Well, one of the strangest things was some clip that I watched where Alison Gold was being asked, is this racist? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is she, 12?
She's 12.
And, you know, hard to say if she's at the top of her class in seventh grade, but she's not. But, you know, I always object to asking anyone to explain their art outside of the art that they're good at. I don't think you ask painters to draw about, to sculpt about their art. I don't think you ask sculptors to talk about their art. You don't ask, you know, architects to sing about it. I mean, the singers are good at one thing only, if that. And I'm not saying if Alison Gold can sing, we'll grant her that. But ask her to then be articulate in prose about what she's doing. You know, don't ask Madonna what her songs mean. That's not her art is not explaining her songs. Her art is singing them. So put Alison Gold up there, say, is it racist? I mean, she's a 12-year-old kid whose parents paid a couple thousand bucks to make a silly video. I don't hold her culpable, is I guess what I'm saying.
We won't be talking about this too much longer, but if you did want to chime in with an opinion, the number, once again, 203-776-WNPR. I'm going to say it nice and slow because some of you are just learning it for the first time. You don't usually hear this number, 203-776-WNPR. I think one of you sort of ultimately, you know, said the thing that is kind of the answer to every criticism about this, which is, we didn't think about it. You know, I mean, one of the things that's kind of clear about this video is that it's done with it's either done unbelievably cannily with the goal of kicking enough tripwires and being annoying enough so that it acquires a kind of snowball effect, or it's done with such innocent exuberance and thoughtlessness, in both the good sense and bad senses of thoughtlessness, that, you know, it looks to me like a video in which, rather than having considered the sensibilities of a whole group of people and deciding not to care about them, they don't have a clue that, I mean, Patrice Wilson or whoever does this video, it doesn't even occur to him that anybody might mind. I don't know if that's a defense of anything. No.
Jen, what do you think?
I don't know. This is the only time in which you could spend a couple of grand, go out, have a song produced for your daughter for probably her birthday or something. Lyrics that someone wrote. He's envisioning this whole thing himself. He's made the video. He's written the lyrics. He's in the videos. He's putting it up on YouTube. And there's no filter whatsoever. You know, this is the first time that happens. I saw somewhere the other day someone talking about the movie The Room and that it was a disaster. Like, people love it because it's such a disaster movie. But that's the whole reason it's a disaster, is that he came up with the money. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He wrote it. He edited it. There was no other voice allowed to be heard. So
the whole Chinese food thing, Friday thing, it strikes me as incredibly Southern California. Mm. That's what it's – and I hold them to different standards. The level of vapidity and silliness that can be produced in the San Fernando Valley is – I don't even apply our normal – you know, effete liberal, do-gooder, politically correct standards to Southern California. They operate by different rules. They have different burger joints. It's just – it's a different country, and I'm just trying to understand their ways.
And remember that Southern California aesthetic, if you will, is what is so captivating to audiences overseas. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sort of epitomizes
right, totally. The vapid American.
A certain, you know, real America.
It does sort of – you know, I've been thinking a little bit lately about the whole question of – and this will bleed nicely maybe into the – next thing we're going to talk about is, to what degree is ignorance and innocence any kind of excuse when you transgress in some of these ways? And I even sort of have it on my own conscience right now, or at least I'm still sort of trying to work something out here.
What you do?
Well, no, I used the word tranny the other day on the air, and the only times I've ever heard the word tranny actually are from people I know who are transsexual who use it to describe themselves. And I was upbraided by one person anyway in an email afterwards who said that was an offensive term. And I mean, it might be, actually. If so, I didn't know. And so then the next question is, well, is that because you're a part of some intellectually gated community where, you know, you're prevented from developing the kinds of sensibilities that you should have? Or was I completely innocent? Or is this person wrong and training's not an offense? I've never figured this out. Feel free to flood my email boxes. It's Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. I'm absolutely prepared to stand corrected one way or another. But my immediate reaction was, well, my heart was pure.
You know? Right.
I might have said this really bad thing. I'm still not sure. But my heart was pure. But, you know, there are other questions that come up. Like, well, then why don't you know that that's a bad thing to say?
Yeah. Well, and I saw a list the other day, and I tried to find it to share with everyone, but it's one of those things that I think when it lives on Facebook, mm-hmm. and you can't search it, it just never exists again. Mm-hmm. And it was a list of things that foreigners say after spending a decent amount of time, not just, you know, 5 days, but living here for 6 months or something and really kind of being immersed in American culture, the things that they found odd about America. And it was a short list. It was like 10 or 12 things. And the thing that people kept saying, besides the fact that our bread is very sweet, apparently, was that we're so outrageously politically correct and so worried about stepping on anyone's toes and like really being careful about choosing which words we use and what implications it might have, and that they found it got in the way of their humor. And that, you know, they felt like they were constantly seen as obnoxious or racist or... And then,
was this a French person talking to us about gender relations?
It was a number of people from all over the world, and they all had the same feeling. And that's one of the things that what's his name again? Patrice
Wilson
said, was that he's lived all over. He was, I think, predominantly in Africa. I don't think he specified where, and the UK, but he's lived all over Europe and all over like Yugoslavia and all over the place. And that when he came here and wanted to kind of export American music elsewhere in the world, he didn't have the same sensibilities of doing it as Americans do. Like, he doesn't know how it works here, so he just did what he knows how to do.
When I was in Japan a number of years ago, the big rage in fashion was for swastikas. Mm. I mean, they didn't know that. I've actually thought about the 12-year-old girls in the Shibuya shopping district there when I saw Alison Gold tried to be articulate about her. And I thought, you know, these are not people who are like deep into the semiotics of what's offensive and what's not. And people I am close to will sometimes tell jokes in which maybe they're not Jewish jokes per se, but it's like a rabbi, a priest, and a whatever. And when they do the rabbi, they slip into some sort of horrible, bad Yiddish accent, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's the version of the Asian, you know, or in this video, the Oriental accent, right? And that never offends me, right? In the way that, say, propagating a a cruel stereotype about Jewish people would, mm-hmm. right? So there's a difference between trying to wring laughs from the accent, which can strike me as affectionate, and trying to wring laughs from saying Jews are like this or like that. So, I mean, these things to some extent are personal, but I guess, you know, we are a polyglot and very diverse country. So you have to – I think goodwill goes a long way. Like, I'm not going to hold – I don't think Alison Gold should be ruined by the anti-bigotry police for this. I mean, she'll have a great career as a fashion stylist or something.
Just to take another sharp term into the semiotics of what can be offensive, we're going to sort of blend this with an episode from The Daily Show this week. You know, it's hard for anything to stand out on The Daily Show as either really funny or outrageous or just an unbelievably, unintentionally, unplanned, crazy moment. But this week, correspondent Asif Manvi was doing one of their sort of, you know, intentionally funny reports about North Carolina's controversial voter ID law. This is sort of some of the backwash from the Supreme Court decision. He talked to a very small-time North Carolina politico, a Republican precinct chair. Of all the Republican precinct chairs and all the joints in North Carolina, he had to bump into a guy named Don Yelton. And Don Yelton and Manvi talked a little bit about the law, and at one point Manvi, in attempting to promote or get a little reaction, a little rise out of this guy, said, well, the law's not racist and you're not racist. And I think that's where our clip here begins.
And there's more.
When I was a young man, you didn't call a black, you called him a Negro. I had a picture one time of Obama sitting on a stump as a witch doctor, and I posted that on Facebook. I was making fun of my white half of Obama, not the black half. And now you have a black person using the term this and that, and it's okay for them to do it.
You know that we can hear you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you know that. You know that we can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
So this montage, it went on a little bit longer than that, and it really did – it got weird. Since then, Yelton has been obliged to resign from his coveted post as precinct chairman for Buncombe County and immediately and has been denounced for it. But, you know, I mean, it almost gets back to what we were talking about before, because he clearly – he does this kind of in the context of – addressing the question of whether or not he's a racist. No, he's a racist, but then he offers up all this very strange evidence that he's not a racist. And here one feels that the defense of innocence is not going to work somehow.
Well, and then he totally tries to pull the I have a black best friend card.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Savage used to always ask people who would talk about, you know, I have a gay best friend. He'd say, who? So I'm going to go find him and ask him how he feels about your opposition to this, that, or the other. Really? You do?
Yeah, although it is the first place you go.
But I want to find Don Yelton of Buncombe County's really close black friend and ask him how he feels about Don. I mean, that'd be the next move as a reporter.
It is the first place that you go. And I know this because when I had my trainee problem, I started to write that as I was writing back to the person. I said, well, really, actually, the first place I ever heard this term was from my friend. And then I thought, oh, no, I'm doing that now. I'm doing that
I'm
thing
that
where I prove I'm that guy. I'm proving that I must be okay because I have a friend in that community. I don't know. Does anybody want to react more to this? Is this anything more than just sort of – I mean, to me, it is like one of those moments where a curtain is pulled back and you realize that you're seeing somebody who talks and thinks in a way that he imagines is acceptable. And as hilarious as the whole thing is, it's hilarious because it's so appalling. Anybody?
You just get a sense that this is somebody who lives in a, you know, completely isolated or perhaps a little pocket of fellow Southern Republicans, who are not dealing with people unlike themselves on any regular basis.
Well, given what we know of small town Southern life, he may in fact be dealing with people unlike himself all the time. And I think that's what's in some ways so troubling, right, is that it's a generational thing where – you know, they can be in close proximity. But I mean, this also isn't regional. I mean, I think it's generational. That would be my thought on it, is that, I encounter people all the time, in the worlds I work in journalism and teaching and stuff, you know, men in their 60s or 70s will talk about the gals, you know, or the girls. And the girl will be a 55-year-old woman who is a colleague, who's their superior.
But you sort of wonder, when is the last member of this generation? I mean, because I feel like...
you don't get that when you're 45. You don't get that. I'm not saying he gets a pass. What I'm saying is that explanation is, you know, one could imagine he looked to be what, 70?
Yeah, it might have been. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm watching Rod Steiger in The Heat of the Night. You know, I mean, where he, you know, of course, famously, eventually says to Sidney Poitier, you know, Virgil's kind of a fancy name for a boy like you. What do they call you back in Philadelphia? And Poitier says, they call me Mr. Tibbs. Right. it's kind of like you're, okay, so, but that was, I saw it in The Heat of the Night when I was a little boy, and I'm not anymore. When is that generation not going to be around? And we have to stop it on that thought because we've got some other things we want to get to. We've got to take a break first. We're here doing the news in New Haven. We'll get back to you after this.
I'm not the woman you thought I'd be. Yes, I've made my mistakes, but listen.
So we've never done this before on the news. First of all, we should welcome back to the studio Jen Stockwell, Helen Cowder, and Mark Oppenheimer. We've never done this before on the news. We talk on the news about things that come up in the culture that are produced by other people. We've never actually had something that was produced by a member of the actual panel that we've talked about. But Mark Oppenheimer welcomed his fourth daughter into the world with an essay in the style of Susan Sontag's On Camp. It was 40 numbered reflections in the publication Medium.com that you heard us describing at the beginning here. I'll just sort of give you a little sample. He writes, my friend Gerardo tells me that, oh, you got a friend. You got a friend, too.
I'm friends with people named Gerardo.
Yeah. My friend Gerardo tells me there is a Caribbean Spanish slang for men who only produce daughters. Chancletero, from chancleta, slipper. That is, I am a man who wears slippers, a slipperisto, if you will. Nobody knows, etymologically speaking, why a man who makes only daughters is thought to be a man in slippers. Because he is not man enough to wear shoes, because he must tread softly, or is it because your daughters will always fetch your slippers for you? Mine, ages 6, 4, 3, and 2 months, do not fetch my slippers. Another of his items is, the father of four has something with the childless man. People's thoughts turn toward his genitals. If you have no children, they wonder if you are capable of having any. When you have four children, they wonder why you can't or won't keep it in your pants. Those with only one, two, or three children don't have this problem. They are genitally normative. And he goes on to say very few Americans have four children these days. In 2010, 19.1% of women between the ages of 40 and 44 had three children, but only 6.8% of women had four children, and only 2.7% of women had five or six children. The piece appears, as we say, on a site called Medium.com, and which I bookmarked immediately. Mark goes on to muse about famous writers who have four children, the fact that Jews don't believe in baby showers. I had no idea about that. The birth rates in other countries and how he feels when somebody says four. That's insane. So, I mean, I'll let you sort of pick it up from here. I mean, right. I want to hear we all loved this piece. We were also, I think, charmed by its frankness and its discursiveness.
I like mining my life for material, partly because I don't get out much. Reporting is harder than it used to be.
And you have four kids.
And I have four kids. So, right. So when we found out we were having a fourth – well, first I was very superstitious about writing about it because you don't want to bring the evil eye on the pregnancy. And so I didn't write anything down. And then we have a beautiful, thank God, like healthy fourth daughter. And I started jotting down reflections. And I figured at some point they'd cohere into like a grand, you know, an elegant lapidary essay of some sort. And they just never did. They just remained scattered reflections. And so I just typed them up like that. And this new site, Medium, is kind of after eccentric, weird stuff like that. So I gave it to them. But yes, four is the number where people just – they do a double take. Nobody does a double take at the person with three kids. But four, you get a lot of long pregnant pauses.
Four of them.
Yes.
Four, yeah, that's right.
I'll just let you guys respond. I don't want to traffic cop the conversation too
so
much.
I realized as soon as I heard this, you know, obviously this is fresh news.
Oh,
so congratulations
order.
Helen. And I'm so impressed and amazed and humbled by all that you do and have four kids. But what struck me was the different reaction that I had to your news to when I heard the exact same news from the crew, the family, the immigrant family that cleans my house, that struggle and that 4 years ago came in with the news that they were going to go from 2 to 3. And did I know of any additional jobs, or were there any other, you know, people that I knew who could, you know, help them? And just last week, and, you know, they bring their kids with them to clean. So, you know, I've gotten to know they're lovely kids, but still, it's really a handful. And they just came in with the news this week that there's another one on the way. And I'm thinking, like, what is it with these people? You know, and...
But with me, it's like, mazel tov.
Right,
that's fabulous.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, people.
And I'm feeling so glum for them and thinking, like, how are they going to make it?
Did they seem glum when they told you?
You know, they were just like fatalistic
like
about
it.
Yeah. They, you know, they had a kind of weird smiles on their face. The hands are going up in the air. You know, it's hard to understand, you know, exactly. They're not interested in, you know, a termination. And so they're facing the facts that they're going to have this.
Well, the blogger Rod Dreher, who blogs for the American Conservative magazine and whom I have a weirdly fraught bromance with that we've never met, but we sort of respect each other. We disagree on a lot of things. He's an Eastern Orthodox Christian and quite conservative. And he posted something that linked to my piece, but he also pointed to a football player, and I don't remember this fellow's name, who's having his 8th child, and he's married, and he's conservative Catholic. And he said the media was making this whole thing about, like, what is he, crazy? 8 children? This is obscene. This is odd. What sort of conservative Catholic weirdos are they? And then Dreher pointed out, actually, I can name a whole bunch of football players where you have 11, 12, 13 kids by 8 different women, by 9 different – this is well-known, well-reported on, and nobody says anything about it because it's just seen as, well, it's a pathology of that community. They have lots of out-of-wedlock kids, but oh well, as good liberals, we don't say anything about it. But God forbid you have lots of kids for religious reasons. So that's only to say that, like, yes, people's reactions are so conditioned by – who it is having the kids and what they think of that community and just all sorts of other things.
But I think as he pointed out, I want to go to Matt from Massachusetts on the phone in just a second. But as Mark pointed out in the piece, I thought in a pretty elegant analogy, it's also conditioned by us, by the observer. And I can't actually quote Mark directly because of one of the words he used. But he said, you know, when you're in your car, the people who are going a lot faster than you are on the highway are
jerks.
Yeah. And the people who are going a lot slower than you are idiots. And he says his family size is kind of that way, too, that you look at other people's families to a certain degree anyway from your own family size, from your own ideas. And, of course, 100 years ago, 4 daughters was no big deal one way or another, except right. that maybe that they were all daughters.
Right. And I was talking to Ben about this last night, my husband, and we've got 2 kids. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And I was saying, you know, like you said, it's not going to turn any heads if you have a kid or two. And then I said, I think the reason that 3 is so normal is that so many people have 2 kids that I feel like most people within a relationship, if you had 2, one of them has thought about having a 3rd. Mm-hmm. Or you've worried that you got pregnant, or you've, you know, just thought what would happen if that were to happen. So that's why I think the 3 is normalized. And then it's like to go past that. And I know a bunch of people who have, my best friend, my sister-in-law, people around the corner from me. I know a bunch of people that have 4 kids. But it seems like you reach a point where that was a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's just the difference.
I want to go to Matt from Massachusetts, who's calling in about this. And any swagger that Oppenheimer has about this is about to be leached right out of him by Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hi. So, I just wanted to add that I have 7 daughters, ages 16 down to 5.
Wow. Congrats, man.
Thanks.
Any sons in there?
No sons, no. I actually only found out for 2 of them. 5 of them were surprised, the sex, I mean.
Okay. And, you know, I just – one of the things that leapt out at me in Mark's piece was this term chancletero. I mean, I love the idea that any language, any idiom within any language had a word for this, for a father who produces only daughters. And did you ultimately parse that any more? Did you have any more?
No, well, so this is my friend Jerry, old dear friend of mine from college, and he said – and his family's – Cuban, and he said, you know, and his brother has three daughters. And he said, you know, at two kids, nobody calls you a chancletero, but at three daughters, you're then like, there's so many of them and they're all daughters. And at that point, you're like the guy with daughters. And there's a word for it. And I said, well, you know, do we know etymologically? And I think he and I spent some time on the internet, and we couldn't – nobody seems to know. It seems to be some of the Caribbean Hispanophone countries, and then I forget if it was Venezuela or Colombia, but one of the northern countries in South America where this slang – I mean, it's not in Spain. You know, it's very specific. And if anyone has ideas, for God's sakes, tweet them to me or something.
Well, the question and this – is often thought of in Asian countries is, you know, are you, is this just on the way to, is, are you just trying until you, a son comes, you know?
Are you asking me, Helen? No,
it's a rhetorical question.
In fact, we don't plan to have more children. And when we found out with each one, after two daughters, with the third, we were so excited it was another girl. We found out with each of them. And with the fourth, we were even more excited. Like, we had great experience with girls. We love having daughters. And this was just like sons, they're into trucks and contact sports, and it just seems like a big mess.
I mean, this is a very poignant question that you asked.
As you know, Helen, being having daughters, right?
My mother was the fourth of four daughters, my grandmother knew when my mother was born that she would then be obliged to have another child, but her husband was not going to let her stop until a son was produced. And she was so furious that this is something my mother never knew in her lifetime, thank God, that her own mother was so furious to have had another daughter that she refused to name my mother. And my mother was actually named by her oldest sister because my grandmother was so furious at this having happened. Well, you know, I mean, the one thing I wanted to sort of have a little bit of time here, we'll be a little bit pressed for time, but as we circulated information, as we looked at different things, we wound up looking at a whole bunch of other things that were kind of gender-related a little bit. I'd been kind of amused and moved by the explorations of Dahlia Lithwick, a writer for Slate Magazine who has sons and a nephew who's been experimenting with the deodorant product Axe, which is, I guess, sort of one of the sort of olfactory ways you really assert your maleness these days. And so Dahlia tried actually wearing Axe products and dousing herself with more and more Axe to see if anybody would react to it or if it made any difference. And then we also started looking at a piece in The Atlantic about sort of the messages sent by high heels and what happens when people who go to tech conferences and who are supposed to be tech entrepreneurs and venture capitalists show up in high heels, which apparently send a whole other sort of message of costumery and semiotics. And I don't even really know where I'm actually going with this conversational overture, except that I keep thinking about Mark and the fact that, you know, in a lot of ways you are going to be watching, four girls grow up with all these explicitly female tropes, some of which you'll probably want to do battle with, just the same way that Dahlia Lithwick wanted to do battle against Axe, right, and the smell of Axe. And I know as we raise kids...
Well, the high heels were interesting. I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what Helen and Jen think about. They went out of fashion for... You didn't see high heels for a while. And I don't know. I have negative stereotypes. I read that piece. I thought, yeah.
You thought, yeah, no one will take you seriously if you wear high heels?
Yeah, that there's something a little cheap
and
about
no one
them.
Should?
No, not that no one should, but that there's something... a little cheap about them.
Jen actually has kind of an unusual shoe history. I've only just met her today, but I already know that. I don't know if you want to sort of lead us down that path in your big clunky male shoes.
Well, because Colin first brought it up that had any of us ever done any of these sorts of things. Had
anybody ever done sort of experimented with the other sex's tropes in some
right.
way?
You know, and I did... And I still do buy men's shoes sometimes. I have big feet. I can wear men's shoes. So I'll find ones at vintage stores or brand new or whatever. So I don't know.
I mean, I feel like it's something like reading Dahlia Lithwick's piece about wearing Axe, body stuff, you know, armpit stuff and cologne and stuff like that. I mean, I think she's ultimately finding kind of a blind alley. What does it mean when you wear all this smelly men's stuff? I mean, it doesn't mean anything to anybody really, except to yourself. And she ultimately embarrasses her son so much that they don't want to wear Axe deodorant anymore or cologne or any other Axe stuff.
So it worked. She scared them off it. It became mom's thing.
On some major anniversary back, Mark and I both used to work at the Hartford Current, though at different times, some major anniversary of pantyhose. My then editor, Kerry O'Connor, persuaded me to wear pantyhose for an entire day. And the only thing I really learned about that was that it's really horrible, and I'm so glad I don't have to wear pantyhose.
Well, talking about horrible, I mean, it can't be as horrible as wearing. When we're talking about heels, these are not just high heels. Mm. These are skyscraper heels. Yeah. And if you look at women, tech conference, you know, young women. I mean, I hate to say it, but even my daughter came home once with such things, and I, you know, promptly said no. But they can't walk in them. Mm-hmm. They're walking around like they're on stilts.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can think of is bound feet. Mm. And, you know, if you remember, before, you know, if you ever saw old Chinese women whose feet had been bound so that the foot would never be larger than this, and they spent their life walking around on little stumps, and basically prisoners. And that's what we're, that's what these, you know, that's to me what these, you know, in addition to being incredibly bad, permanently bad for your legs and your feet, you know, we're just this fetish. You know, this fetishization is really harmful.
And that, I mean, I completely agree. And I think that would be my reaction if any of my kids were to want to wear really high heels. And again, you make the point, there's heels and then there's heels, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these were the ones in the picture were like really, mm-hmm. you know, precariously high heels. But then there's the woman quoted in, I think, the Atlantic article who says, look, I'm short, and people judge, you know, short women get passed over for things. And, you know, if it gives you an extra couple inches. So, I mean, I had a, you know, a little wave of sympathy for her there.
I wear platforms.
Yeah. I mean, I'm short and, you know, I wear sneakers, so.
Yeah, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that there's a couple points that, yes, in the picture, the heels that the woman's wearing at the tech conference, that is the real picture, right, that the guy took. I think so.
Yeah.
They are stilettos. So there's something different that goes along with stilettos. I think they do send a different message. I think it matters if you know how to carry yourself and how to walk. And, you know, I agree that they are damaging and they're not good for you to wear every day. And I think we've all known older women in our lives who, even when they're 80 and 90, have to wear heels because they've worn them for their entire lives and things like that. I've had friends, grandmothers and the like that had to do that sort of thing because their feet are just so used to it at that point. They can't wear flat shoes. So I can understand that. But at the same time, I thought that he, in those tweets, tried to back out of it by saying it was women's health that he was really,
right.
you know, just, trying to protect
just to put
and
this
look
in a
after,
little,
which it, I just took as pandering and trying to back out of it.
Or pandering.
And I just feel like we have these choices. You know, I know if wearing high heels is going to take like a year off my life, I think I'd rather wear high heels every once in a while and live to 89 instead of 90. I don't know. I think we have these choices.
Oh, I thought you were going the other direction with that. I thought you were saying, give me a year on my life.
No, I'd rather have the choice to
ever. You're saying it's only a year. I'll live to 89 instead of 90.
I probably should have laid this groundwork before we get into the conversation, but just to sort of give you a sort of a sense of what precipitated this, it was, in fact, I think a New York event for startup people, venture capitalists, part of people, part of the digital community. A CEO of a healthcare startup noticed a female attendee wearing shoes. He snapped a picture of these high-heeled shoes, these stiletto high-heeled shoes. He then tweeted the picture of the shoes, and in his tweet he said, "Event supposed to be for entrepreneurs, VCs, but these heels, I've seen several like this. What are you WTF ? And then he hashtagged brains not required. And there is, first of all, something about sneaking up on somebody and taking a picture of their high heels without their knowledge or consent that's, you know, akin to walking around in a panda costume and tickling little girls, too. I mean, there's just something a little odd about this anyway. And it did seem anyway.
Although, if you're going to take pictures of people, I mean, their feet is about the most harmless, right? I mean, if someone were following me around snapping pictures, better my feet than my face or my rear.
Up your skirt.
Yeah, I mean, like... But I take
one
I
of these days,
point.
Somebody's going to sneak up on one of those beautiful little daughters of yours at some kind of conference and take
and
pictures
snap
of her
shoes. I mean,
and tweet something judgmental about it, and you're going to want to go down and deck the guy. You're going to lose all that.
God willing, one of my daughters at a venture capital conference someday. She can support me in my old age.
All right, we're going to have to call it quits here a little bit because we have to have time to endorse. I've got a little announcement to make too, so we'll take a break. We'll come back.
Since the day she saw him walking away, now she's left cleaning up the mess he made. So fathers, be good to your daughters. Daughters will learn like you do.
Those Dennis Rodman and Kim Jong-un pistachio commercials make me so nostalgic for Neville Chamberlain's Mr. Peanut ads. Today's show was produced by... Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me. Our intern is Corey Breen. The part of Bill Curry was played by Orlando Bloom. On Monday, we're kicking off a new kind of show. Here's Colin to tell you more.
Yeah, just very quickly, I have two things to tell you. First of all, why Wolfie is crying, and then what kind of show we're going to do. Actually, I'll do it in reverse. So on Monday, we as you can probably tell, we actually plan these shows out days and weeks, sometimes in advance, book guests and do a lot of producing. We're not going to do that Monday. We're going to come in on Monday morning, and at 9 o'clock, we're going to decide what was talkable from the weekend. What do people really want to talk about? We'll book guests as quickly as we can. We're really hoping that that phone calls become a bigger part of this particular show than they are in a lot of our shows. So work with us on this. This is an experiment. We may never do it again. Now, one reason we're doing an experiment is because we have come to kind of a crossroads. 4 years ago, three of us started the show together, Kyone Wolf, Patrick Scahill, and I. Patrick Scahill is about to become a full-time reporter at WNPR, which means that he's leaving us. And I would need 10 minutes to actually explain what that means, but it's a pretty big thing. We do feel like we've lost this titanic figure. And so much about what's good about this show comes from Patrick Scahill. He holds himself to higher standards than any of us could ever hold him to. And he absolutely is the central nervous system of it and its conscience. Although that's not a big accomplishment because Wolfie and I don't have highly developed consciences. But anyway, he's been so much. There's no way that we can ever possibly describe it. We feel a little lost right now, as I was saying earlier today. First of all, we were very lucky that another person came into our lives. I feel like I'm telling kids that they're going to have new parents or something. But there's another person now. Her name is Betsy Kaplan. You probably hear us talk about her a lot. She's going to be doing a lot of what Patrick used to do. She's going to be a full-fledged producer of this show. She's going to be great. But she and Wolfie and I do feel like Jack Russell Terrier standing in the 50-yard line of the Rose Bowl. We feel very small, and you know, because this titanic figure in our midst is leaving. But anyway, we're going to try to soldier on without Patrick. A couple of quick announcements here. First of all, I just happened to find out today Jerry Seinfeld will perform at the Bushnell on January 11th. Tickets go on sale November 1st. You heard it here from me first. Also, on Thursday night, I'll be with Penn Jillette at Penn and Teller fame at the Mark Twain House with an interview. Tickets are available for that. And people should know that the Oddball, a cherished Hartford event, is happening on Saturday night. It's a sort of Halloween costume-themed event, and you can contact Real Art Waste about this. So we do ask our panels to come in and endorse something, give you a recommendation or two. Mark Oppenheimer, what have you got?
I'm about a third of the way through Donna Tartt's new novel.
Oh, wow.
The Goldfinch, which and some of you might have read. There's only her third novel. She comes out with one every 10 years, mm-hmm. and 20 years ago she came out with The Secret History, the very, very macabre tale of a secret society of classics majors at a small New England college that ends in murder and assorted other intrigue. And it was fabulous. And then her second book, which I didn't read, didn't do as well, and now she's out with this new one, The Goldfinch, and it's getting great reviews, and I'm loving it so far. Completely great. The other thing I want to endorse is a friend of mine, my friend Craig Fehrman, Fehrman, has a new Amazon single, a Kindle single out, which is like an extended article, like, you know, it's sort of a novella length piece. And it's about the rock and roll scene in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and specifically the band Cage the Elephant, which apparently has ignited one of the coolest local indie music scenes this side of like Seattle 1991. Mm-hmm. And the single is just a heck of a read, and you can get it at Amazon shop for download Z's.
All right. Only 2 minutes left, so we need quick recommendations from Helen Cotter.
I want to endorse in this week's New Yorker, there's a piece by David Sedaris.
Yes. Yes.
And I was fortunate enough to actually hear him read read this piece earlier in the week when he was at the Schubert Theater. It's called The Beach House. He wanted to call it the C section. Mm. And it's kind of the flip side of Mark's story. It's a family that goes from five children to four when his sister takes her own life, and it happened recently. And it's really bittersweet. There's so much family angst, and you just got to read it.
Okay, we have to wrap up real fast. Jen Stockwell, fire one endorsement at us.
Well, I'm going to go lowbrow and say everyone should watch Human Centipede 2. If you watch the first one for the same reason you might listen to Friday, because it is just a crazy
movie. Do you need the first
movie
to understand the second?
You have to watch the first one, but the second one classes it up. It's in black and white.
All right. That was Below Lowbrow. Thanks very much to Jen Stockwell and to Helen Cotter and to Mark Oppenheimer. We'll be back on Monday with this unusual surprise show.
Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington,
I'm Kyone Wolf. Dear Patrick Scahill, I understand you're breaking up with us here at the Colin McEnroe Show, and we'll always love you. Thanks for everything, Patrick.